So how do we practice? We start by practicing with small things. The little slights. You know those little slights that happen? The people that we live with and work with. We start by practicing letting go. What does it feel like just to release that? The practice of seeing something that caused suffering, someone that did something, and instead of contracting around it, holding ourselves and them with compassion and letting it pass. If you imagine it, you can feel the relief in your own body. Letting go of our fears. What if I don't carry this? What if I don't worry about it? Maybe it'll all happen again. The wonderful Persian poet Hafiz says, "Fear is the cheapest room in the house. I'd like to see you in better living conditions." Let go of the fear. So each day we get a chance over and over in little ways to empower the heart of forgiveness, to renew our life, to be tender again. Do not ignore the effects of each wise action, says the Buddha, thinking this will come to nothing. Just as by the gradual fall of raindrops, the water jar is filled, so in time the wise become filled with the sweetness and goodness of their actions. Just let yourself breathe and remember this human capacity to let go, to meet even difficulty with mercy and kindness. Now, it's also important to understand that it's not just in the little things, the small ones, or that simple story of the golf course and DiVincenzo, but there's an amazing depth as well to forgiveness. And many of us carry grave wounds from our family or injustices of the world that we have suffered. What about forgiveness there or here? No matter how extreme the circumstances, a transformation of your own heart is possible in its time. Tell you a story. Once, when I was riding on the train from Washington, D.C. up to Philadelphia to go to my father's funeral, I found myself seated, or I sat down, next to an interesting-looking African-American gentleman who, as we began to converse, turned out had worked for the State Department in India for a long time, but had quit and now ran a rehabilitation program for juvenile offenders in the District of Columbia. And most of the young men he worked with had come out of the gangs and were gang members who had committed homicide, kind of the toughest work. And then he told me the story of one 14-year-old boy in his program who'd come in at 14, who had shot and killed an innocent teenager to prove himself to the gang. And he was caught, and at the trial, the victim's mother sat impassive and silent until the very end, when this young man was convicted of the killing. And after the verdict was announced, she stood up slowly and stared directly at him in the eye and said, "I'm going to kill you," and then sat back down. And he was taken away to serve some years in a juvenile facility. And after the first year had passed, the mother of the child that was killed paid a visit to his killer. He'd been living on the streets before this, and she was about the only person who visited him. And they talked for a time, and when she left, she gave him some money for cigarettes and said she'd visit him again. And she started little by little to visit him, bringing him food and little gifts. And after he'd been in for several years, she asked him, when he was getting close to being released, what he was going to do when he got out. And he was confused. He didn't know. So she offered to set him up with a job in the company of a friend of hers. And then it got closer, and she said, well, where are you going to live? He had no place to go. So she offered him temporary use of a spare room in her house. And for 8 months he lived there and ate her food and worked at this job. And then one evening she called him in the living room and she sat down opposite him and waited. And then she said, do you remember in the courtroom that day when I said, I'm going to kill you? He said, I sure do. I'd never forget that moment. Well, I did, she went on. I did not want the boy who could kill my son for no reason to remain alive on this earth. And that's why I started to visit you and bring you things. And that's why I got you the job and let you live here in my house. And that's how I set about changing you. And that old boy, he's gone. So now I want to ask you, since my son is gone and that killer is gone, if you'll stay here, because I've got a room and I'd like to adopt you if you'll let me. And she became the mother of the killer of her own son, the mother that he never really had. Now, sometimes when we hear a story like that, it's so big, you wonder, what could you do? What could I do? But we need to know that even when the betrayal is so deep, we don't have to live our life in that betrayal. We don't have to go back into it, but we can change it. Sometimes you have to honor all the parts of it, the grief, the sorrow, the loss. In the monasteries, when there's a grave conflict, the story is told and everybody bows to the suffering and sits with it for a time. And then they engage in a practice called covering mud with straw, where in the end all the mud of the sorrow is present and told and bowed to, and finally straw is placed on top so that the human beings can again walk without going back and sinking into it.